All right. Well, I'm looking forward to this. You know, it's now how many churches in America are talking about Karl Marx tonight and the Communist Manifesto? Well, actually, a lot of liberal churches probably come to think of it. But how many true churches get to talk about Marx, one of the most absolutely one of the most influential people of the last 200 years in Western civilization? And of course, his influence has been overwhelmingly negative. But we want to treat him with fairness and honesty. And actually, as a social critic, he has a lot to say and a lot that we can learn from, which is the case with quite a few of these authors that we're talking about in this course. Even people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and some of the others, the problem is not necessarily their critique of their society and culture. The problem is their recipe for improving their society and culture. And invariably, their solution to the problems is far worse than the maladies themselves. So, like I said, we'll treat Marx in an honest way, and again, I think there's a lot there that we can benefit from. So, anyway, it's a lot to talk about, but please, as always, feel more than welcome, you know, to enter in, and any relevant questions, comments, whatever, as we work through this material. All right, so what we have in Karl Marx is a bona fide firebrand revolutionary, and you can tell just by looking at him that this is a man who at least wanted us to take him seriously, you know, and he certainly looks the part, doesn't he? So, and what about the Communist Manifesto? Well, how many of you have read it? It's actually not very long. It's, oh no, am I alone? Among us,
it's been decades. I'm sure I've read it sometime.
Yeah. It's actually not very long. I guess 40 or 50 pages, something like that. It's actually more of a pamphlet than a book, and it's published in 1848. And it is brilliant propaganda. I mean, you know, first rate propaganda. Very passionate, very incendiary rhetoric. For instance, in his prologue. And you've probably heard this from past experience. Marx writes that a specter is haunting Europe. A specter sounds eerie and scary and all. A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. All the powers of old Europe, all the old, you know, decadent powers to be in the continent, have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this specter, in other words, to defeat this specter. Because, of course, they're the people in power and position and status, and they want to preserve the status quo. And he goes on to say that it's high time that communists should openly publish their views and their aims. Now, this is very interesting, see, because for most of the 20th century, communist revolutionaries tried their best to hide their agenda and their aims and so on. But Marx, of course, is writing back in the middle of the 19th century and saying, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We want revolution. We want an overthrow of the system. And so we're going to be very upfront, you know, about what our goals are. And then from the epilogue, communists disdain, he says, to conceal their values and aims. They openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions, violent revolution. He'll make the case in the Communist Manifesto that incremental democratic style change doesn't work. Things are so bad in the existing order that only a violent revolution will accomplish their means. Let the ruling classes tremble at the communistic revolution. The proletarians, the underclass, working class, have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a whole world to win. Working Men of the World Unite. So again, it's he's a good writer, and as I said, first-rate propaganda. Now, in terms of the number of people directly impacted by his book, the Communist Manifesto is certainly one of the most significant books ever written, along with the Bible, the Quran, and Charles Darwin's early books. And in terms of the number of people who have been tyrannized and abused and murdered as a result of a book, the Communist Manifesto probably is in a category of its own. In the 20th century alone, an estimated 100 to 120 million people were murdered in communistic dictatorships. And so the question oftentimes comes up, and that is it fair to blame Karl Marx for the brutality of a Lenin, a Stalin, a Mao Zedong, a Pol Pot, a Castro, people like that? And it's a debatable point, certainly, but what we can say with certitude is that all these tyrants and mass murderers share one common denominator. They were all disciples of Karl Marx. So whether or not, they were interpreting him correctly or not, they all certainly considered themselves to be loyal followers of Karl Marx. By the way, the one who gets a pass in this respect would be, of course, Adolf Hitler. And but what was the name of Hitler's movement early on? What later, we call the Nazi Party. I mean, what actually is the official name? National Socialist Party. It was actually just a rival socialist alternative to the communists. Yes,
Bob.
I don't think so. I mean, Russia didn't. For a very brief time near the end of World War I, Russia had a democratic socialist government after they overthrew the Tsar, but that didn't last long before the Bolsheviks, the hardcore communists, took over. And I don't think like Cuba and some of these places, or China, I don't think they were socialist before. Yeah, through violent revolution. Yeah. Now, when it comes to Western progressive nations, Europe, Britain, United States, and all, the case could be made that it's an incremental process. All right, so what's the essence of socialism? Well, Karl Marx is anything but the first socialist theoretician. There were others who preceded him, but most of them were what we would call utopian socialists or democratic socialists. For instance, we have Count Henri Saint-Simon in France. And Saint-Simon was a Christian socialist, a Christian utopian socialist. And in fact, in 1824, he wrote a book called New Christianity, in which Saint-Simon was trying to argue that the Christian faith was in essence humanitarianism, brotherly love, and care for the moral and the economic needs of the underclass. And so Saint-Simon, Charles Fourier, Robert Owen, Proudhon, others like that, preceded Karl Marx. But Marx would have relatively little respect for these people because he thought they were too moderate. And again, they were utopian socialists. And Marx wanted to draw a distinction between himself and his doctrines as opposed to all these other socialists. And so Marx will claim that his ideas are based on historical study, or what he called scientific socialism. In other words, he's going to claim that he's discovered the keys to historical development through the centuries. And so he's going to try and separate himself. He is a true social scientist in his own mind, as opposed to these utopian and even Christian socialists who he feels like are pretty naive, really. So he's a hardcore, you know, serious scholar and thinker. At least that's what he would like for us to believe. So what is socialism? Well, it's a real nebulous term. People throw it around all the time. It's very ill-defined. It can be used for everything from hardcore Marxist communist totalitarianism to British-style social democracy to the communalism of the early church in Jerusalem. So, socialism, to use that term, it really doesn't tell us much. Historically, some socialists have, again, been very extreme like Marx and wanted the state to control or own virtually everything. Other socialists just want more government regulation over the economy and government regulation over key industries and so on, but not government ownership. Extreme socialists like Marx would call for the abolition of all private property. Most socialists haven't gone anywhere near that far, but socialists, generally speaking, do want a more equitable redistribution of wealth in society. So that's something that, you know, they generally would share in common. Now, since socialism is fundamentally an economic system and only secondarily a political system, let's look at the components of an economic system in general. And basically, we just have two elements of any economic system. One is, how do you generate wealth? How do you generate goods and services? In other words, how do you produce wealth? And then secondly, the distribution of wealth or the distribution of goods and services. Now, think about it logically here, and that is it would be counterproductive to try and put the cart before the horse, to put more emphasis on distribution of wealth rather than the production of wealth, because you've got to be producing wealth in order to even open up a discussion of how it ought to be shared. Now, one of the problems with socialism historically is that they've concentrated and fixated so much on the redistribution of wealth and not enough on how wealth is created. So again, as I said, it's sort of tantamount to putting the cart before the horse, and it's almost assured that when you reverse the order there, you're going to eventually destroy the productive wealth-creating base for any society. Now, there are many Christians who are very sympathetic to socialism, at least mild forms of socialism, and then there's other Christians that are, you know, pretty adamantly opposed to it. And I've come to understand over the years that our economic theories have a lot to do with our basic worldview, in particular our understanding of human nature, as we keep coming back to in the study. Also, our understanding of justice. Now, the greatest, most profound insights into true social justice that have ever been written are some of the prophets of the Old Testament. So today, especially among many conservatives, the idea of social justice is a virtual obscenity. But we should all be in favor of social justice. The question is, what exactly is it? You know, what is true social justice? Because that's a term that's been co-opted and used, I think, very dishonestly by the left throughout the 20th century. How we look at economics depends in large measure on our understanding of human nature, our understanding of what true justice, social justice is, and also our views on wealth. In other words, how is wealth created and how should it be distributed? Now, regarding that last issue related to wealth, there's two general views. And one would be that wealth is created in a society through individual initiative, intelligence, and productivity. In other words, this view would hold that the wealthy in society are typically the best people in society. They're the most creative, the most brilliant people in society, because after all, this is the entrepreneurial class that generates new ideas, starts new companies, employs people, you know, productively, pays them accordingly, and so on. And so according to this view, the rich in society are actually our best and our brightest people. And so if you believe that, then you would believe that taxes need to be very, very low so as to encourage as much as possible entrepreneurial development, okay? So that's one view. The other view is that wealth is created primarily by taking by some people taking advantage of their social and their political connections and exploiting their fellow man. In other words, this view would hold, see, that the rich have oftentimes inherited their wealth and they're totally undeserving of it. And among those who have produced wealth on their own, these people are usually among the most clever and cunning and unscrupulous of everybody in society. And so rather than being our best people, the rich in every society are actually our worst people. And so these so-called entrepreneurs are nothing much more than just capitalist pigs. And they get rich off of exploiting the working classes and so on. Now, if you bought into that view, then of course you would probably hold that taxes should be extremely high so as to penalize these people for all their greed. In other words, this soak the rich concept. So here we have two polar opposite views as far as how wealth is created and how should that wealth be distributed. And of course, as in most of these kind of scenarios, those two extreme positions, I don't think either one necessarily correlates with reality. Reality is a whole lot more complex than either of those polar opposite positions. Any comments, by the way, thoughts on that before we move on? So how do people get rich? Well, they're our best people, our most intelligent and creative people. No, they're our worst people. They're the most cunning, devious, deceptive people who take advantage of their advantages that they have in life, and they exploit others for their own greed and purpose. Okay. Yeah, both are true, and neither's totally true. I mean, depending on the society, right?
Would you give us your best definition of social justice?
Ooh, well, I'd say we just go back to the Old Testament prophets, probably Amos and others, and I think. I tried to write about that in the little booklet on natural law, and I should have brought some of those tonight because I think social justice is something that Christians should be very concerned with. Okay, honesty and an honest concern for the poor, those that struggle in life, and so on. But again, it's real easy to opt for one of these simplistic extreme positions on it.
It's not redistribution.
Correct. If you look at the church in Jerusalem, and we don't know how, the early church in Jerusalem was at least for a little while, and we don't know if this went on for several months or several years. There's no historical validation for either. But it was a little communistic society, wasn't it? It was a little communalistic society. But obviously, it was a voluntary society where people are voluntarily sharing their wealth and their resources with their fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. And so to call it voluntary makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it? I mean, that one word is what it's all about, as opposed to government-coerced attempts to redistribute wealth involuntarily.
So.
Right.
In your hand, yours, before you make a decision.
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, they didn't have to share their wealth with others. Their sin was in claiming that they, dishonestly, that they had, sold and distributed all of it. Yeah. Any other thoughts,
Would
Bob?
You say then that the essence of socialism is sort of that second scenario you described?
Yes. Generally,
wicked people exploit.
Yeah.
So that's a fundamental of
I think that socialists generally agree that for the most part, the wealthy, the rich, the powerful are great exploiters. But again, some are more extreme than others. But I think, yeah, that would be the general socialist orientation. All right, now, what would be some general tenets of socialism? Well, first of all, it starts, as we said, with a critique of the rich. In other words, the rich exploit society a lot more than they actually contribute to society. Okay. Secondly, socialists generally would call for government regulation or ownership of the major means of production. In other words, key industries. You think, okay, what are the key industries in any society? Well, energy production, transportation, communication, education. And socialists would say that to some extent or another, government needs to be regulating, if not, to use a stronger word, controlling all these key industries for the general welfare of everybody in society. And so, in other words, this is what's necessary for the common good of all. Yeah, Dan?
Many of these industries have since been privatized or partially privatized, but all of us will have heard of British Petroleum, British Rail, British Steel, British Broadcasting. All of those were originally state enterprises, or companies like British Leyland that had originally been private, and then the government, mm-hmm. like Amtrak or Conrail, mm-hmm. takes over an existing private, nationalizes very.
And how does that work in general?
The capitalist critique of that would be that the incentives for high productivity and customer service are somewhat lacking.
Right, right. Yeah, which is a delicate way of saying that generally that's been a failure, when government has tried to take over those kind of industries. Now, also under socialism, there's an emphasis on equalitarianism in society rather than individual liberty. I mean, that's not to say that some socialists don't value individual liberty, but they're more concerned with the equal, egalitarian distribution of wealth and opportunities in society so as to narrow the gap between the rich and the poor. Another earmark of socialism is sort of an orientation that values collectivism. In other words, a concern for the collective welfare rather than private individual welfare. Then fifthly, promotion of social cooperation rather than competition in society. And this is where I'd say, one of the critical problems here in left-wing ideologies, whether it's pretty mild socialism or extreme Marxist communism, is this rather naive notion that we can create a society in which it just unleashes all the goodness and all the malevolence within individuals, and we can transform people from being basically competitive with one another to being just totally open and cooperative and sharing. Now, this is based, of course, on, I think, a faulty view of human nature. Again, it's that view that Rousseau held and all these socialists hold, and that is that mankind is basically good, but what's corrupted human history has been unjust social and political and economic systems. So if we can just create a more just society, then it will unleash all this inherent goodness within humanity. And again, instead of having a very competitive society, we'll have a society that's very much characterized by cooperation. Lastly, there would be, again, an emphasis on redistribution of wealth through taxation policies and through social welfare programs. And again, if you believe that the rich primarily have been parasites, then they need to be punished. And so we need high taxes on the rich, and we need to confiscate some of their wealth and redistribute some of their wealth in terms of social welfare programs for the people that are struggling in society. So, other comments. Bob?
Are there any socialists that really take seriously the whole question of the production of wealth? Where does wealth come from? Because
it's
that view that you're here, our job is to penalize wealth and take from the wealth. What does actually create wealth? Where does new money come from?
So you'd have to have this really naive belief that St. Simon, that early Christian socialist I mentioned, it's St. Simon who came out with the phrase, from each according to their ability, to each according to his need. And again, St. Simon is naive in this respect. He has an inflated view of basic human nature. Now, there have been so many examples historically that this just frankly doesn't work. One of the best examples in American history was our second colony that was ever founded, Plymouth Colony, founded by very sincere, devout Christians. And for the first 3 or 4 years, the Plymouth Colony practiced a form of communalism. They didn't have private property or anything like that. And the colony virtually starved to death. And as soon as they divided up the land into private property lots, and everybody had to fend for himself and feed his own family, productivity went up dramatically. And again, these are good Christian people. But, I don't know what, rightly or wrongly what we attribute it to in human nature. But unless there's something in it for us directly, human beings just are not going to be that benevolent, not that cooperative. So this is just endemic to human nature, and maybe it's, related to the fall. We're all, innately egoistic, self-centered people, but that's reality. That's reality. This socialist ideal is not reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, as we go through Marx here, you'll see that a lot of his critique of his society in his day is right on target. It's just that he doesn't have a clue when it comes to the solution to these problems. Well, let's take a look at Karl Marx himself, okay? You see the dates there of his life, 1818 to 83. He's one of the most influential thinkers of the 19th and 20th centuries. The man certainly was a man of ability. He was a major historian, economist, philosopher. He was one of the first sociologists. He's also a journalist. He was actually an expert on the American Civil War. In fact, the very little, amount of money that he ever made in his life, part of it was writing articles for British newspapers about the American Civil War. So he was, a competent scholar. He's also a journalist, but of course we know him mostly as a revolutionary. Other than that, I think what we could say is that he was a formidable screwball. That's a word we ought to use more often. Screwball. You don't hear that word much anymore, but when it comes to Karl Marx, he's a screwball. Okay? he's born into a well-to-do bourgeois German family. He gets a privileged education. He studies at the University of Berlin under the great philosopher Hegel there. And but after he's finished and takes his PhD finals, he tries to stay on and get a university, a prestigious university appointment, but he's passed over. And most of his biographers think that the reason he was passed over probably has to do with the fact that the man had a very abrasive personality. And this makes him very bitter for the rest of his life. And so I think for a lot of the rest of his life and his writings and all is very, you know, confrontational, vociferous language, I think, is just based on the fact that he was a very, very bitter individual. Now, he leaves Germany and begins to live in Paris, which is where a lot of kind of disaffected, kind of radical types hang out back in the middle of the 19th century and, of course, as you know, into the 20th century as well. And then in 1848, there's a series of revolutions that spread throughout most of Europe, all the way from Russia to Great Britain. Actually, we call these the revolutions of 1848. And in Germany, the revolution was particularly intense. And it's in that context that he writes the Communist Manifesto. And he basically writes that for the Communist League in Germany. And his purpose is really not to write a philosophical treatise on government or economics. His purpose is to spark a revolution. He wants to see the overthrow of the German government, and actually governments all throughout Europe. Those revolutions fail, and of course he couldn't dare go back to Germany. He would probably be arrested and thrown into prison. So he lives the second half of his life, the last half of his life, basically in exile in London. And the man rarely ever holds a steady job. He works part-time as a journalist. But he spends a lot of his days going to the reading room in the British Museum. Some of you have been to London and the British Museum. And, you know, they have plaques, you know, commemorating, you know, that this is where Karl Marx hung out for, or loitered probably for, for years of his life. And all as he was working on his magnum opus, which is called Das Kapital, a critique of capitalism. Okay, now, Marx is certainly an atheist, but he also has the persona of an angry social prophet. The man has a very dominating temper, very acerbic in the way he expresses himself. Years later, one man who knew him quite well, Carl Schurz, will write, quote, "I've never seen a man whose bearing was so provoking and intolerable." I mean, you know, he sounds like an extremely arrogant, you know, condescending person. Of course, Carl Schurz never met James Carville, did he? But anyway, just as an aside. But anyway, he goes on to say, To no opinion which differed from his own did he accord the honor of even condescending consideration. I mean, he's totally dismissive of anybody that might question or challenge him on anything. Everyone who contradicted him, he treated with abject contempt. Every argument that he did not like, he answered either with biting scorn or the unfathomable ignorance that had promoted it, or with aspersions upon the motives of him who had advanced it. He denounced everyone who dared to oppose his opinion. So this is somebody who, you know, is totally intolerant and, again, apparently just overwhelmingly arrogant and dominating and so on, which is why, by the way, when he died in 1883... there was a grand total of, now this is somebody who was world renowned. You know, people in America knew Karl Marx. People all over the world knew Karl Marx. When he died and was buried there in London in 1883, 11 people showed up at his funeral. And you would have expected thousands and thousands again because he was so world renowned. The man rarely ever worked to support his family. For the most part, his family lives in poverty. In fact, at times it was worse than that. They live in squalor. And they survive mainly as a result of the charity of one of Marx's staunchest allies and friends, Friedrich Engels. Now, Friedrich Engels co-wrote the Communist Manifesto. Friedrich Engels was sort of the spoiled brat son of a very wealthy English industrialist. So Friedrich Engels grew up amidst money. He had a big inheritance, and a lot of that he shared with Marx and kind of kept Marx and his family alive for many, many years. Now, three of Marx's five children died, mainly due to very unsanitary, wretched living conditions. When an infant daughter died, for instance, Marx couldn't even afford a coffin for the girl. And so three of his children die at an early age, starvation or just, you know, again, just unsanitary living conditions. Of the two who survived, both of those daughters committed suicide later. So it's, by all accounts, and Marx, by the way, is constantly carrying on affairs, sexual affairs with other women and so on, and with the maid, and so on. So it's just a deplorable, you know, living environment. And like I said, his benefactor during these years is Friedrich Engels, his collaborator. And like Marx, Engels is a very militant atheist and a notorious philanderer as well. All right. So Karl Marx, any questions about him before we move on?
Why was he sheltered in England? Where did he start from? He escaped Germany, but why was he sheltered in England?
Well, I would guess because Great Britain was probably the freest and most open country, you know, in the world at that time. I mean, at least, you know, maybe aside from the United States, you know. So what you find, and this is a recurring theme throughout the 20th century, a lot of these hardcore leftists, when they get run out of a country, you notice, well, for instance, the Marxists who started the Frankfurt School in Germany. Now, these were a bunch of neo-Marxists who in the 1920s started a Marxist university, basically, in Frankfurt, okay? And when the Nazis take over, these people's lives are in danger, okay? But you notice none of these communists fled to the Soviet Union for sanctuary. They all came to Britain and America, you know, free countries. Open countries. What's that?
Free speech.
Yeah, yeah. Where they could continue their work undermining, you know, the American system and so on, the British system. All right, well, let's take a look at Marxism. And what's unique about this character? Like we said, there's lots of socialists running around in Europe at the time, some in America at the time. So what's unique about Karl Marx? Well, see, unlike a lot of these other revolutionary firebrands, this guy comes across as a serious scholar, and he's using historical and sociological research, attempting to validate his theories scientifically in accord with social science. And so what he does is present this grand panoramic view of history, and he claims that he's discovered the laws of historical progression. In other words, he's discovered what makes history happen, say, and he traces it from the early Greeks all the way down to his time. And to distinguish his theory from all these other socialist theories, he'll call his particular interpretation of history, quote, scientific socialism. And again, see, he'll brush off the others as being utopian socialism. Now, his philosophy of history is basically an indictment of Western civilization in general. And he's going to be borrowing an approach to criticism from his old university professor, Hegel. Hegel had taught this dialectical approach in which, according to Hegel, what moves history along is what Hegel called great ideas. In other words, every major period in history is dominated by a spirit or a great idea. And eventually a contradictory or counter idea comes along that challenges the prevailing one. And out of this dialectical struggle between them emerges a new synthesis and a new historical epoch. So, for instance, with Hegel, see, great ideas would include, for instance, the advent of democracy in ancient Greece. A great idea would be the advent of philosophy in ancient Greece. Another great idea would be Christianity, which had a profound effect, you know, on human history. Another great idea would be, for instance, the Enlightenment. And then other great ideas would be the advent of mercantilism and then finally the advent of capitalism. And so for Hegel, this is what moves history, see. There were alternative philosophies of history, including you've probably heard of the great man theory, you know, that it's great men. Now, again, not necessarily good men. In fact, almost always they weren't good men, but they're great men who come along and dramatically change history. And Hegel said, no, that's nonsense, because even these great men come out of a certain philosophical context in their society. So it's great ideas. So Marx borrows that dialectical idea from Hegel, but in fact Marx is actually anti-Hegelian in that Marx discounts the whole idea of great ideas and higher values. He says those are not what motivates change in history. In other words, values like altruism or patriotism or religion or concepts of justice or equality, that's not what matters in history. See, Marx is a hardcore atheist. He's philosophically, he's a naturalist and a materialist. And so Marx will interpret human history in the context of what we call dialectical materialism. In other words, history, he says, is a series of dialectical struggles. And what really matters is economics and the class struggle. It's not great ideas, it's not higher values or ideals that's the primary motivating factors in history. It's the class struggle, see? In other words, economic forces, that's what it's all about. And history is all about constant tension and conflict between the haves and the have-nots, between the rich and the poor, between the exploiters and the exploited. So according to Marx, that's what drives history. That's the substructure of a society on which the superstructure, in other words, the political and religious systems and so on, are based. Now, Marx's interpretation here is really pretty simplistic and superficial. He's attributing historical progression to a single cause, which is frankly just absurd, whatever that single cause might be. But, you know, we do have to give him credit for the fact that prior to Karl Marx, historians had generally overlooked the economic factors in terms of what drives history. So Marx comes along and emphasizes economic factors, but in the process, he overemphasizes it, and again, to the point where it becomes absurd, his basic argument. Now, in this context, see, Marx is going to argue that we're not self-determining individuals. We don't have any free will. Free will's an illusion. We may think that we have decided to sort of chart our own course in life and go our own way and so on. But actually, all of our values and all of our beliefs and our behavior, see, all of this is determined by economic considerations, by our social class, and by our vocation. See, we're essentially economic creatures, and we're really just products of our work environment and of our social class. So again, is there any truth in this? Yeah, there's truth in this, but it's not the whole truth, is it? We all know people that go above and beyond, or below and beneath, their social class and their conditions and their vocation and so on. Now, like Ray, I spent years in academia, and there's certainly a dominant ethos, especially in my fields, which were social sciences and humanities. So there's definitely a dominant way of thinking in, for instance, history and so on. But that doesn't mean that every historian, just kind of mindlessly, falls along with the fads and the trends of the day. But according to Marx, what you do determines what you are. Okay. So your social class, that's the determining factor, and your vocation, that's the determining factor in all of your values and your beliefs and so on. So again, you think, well, yeah, there's some truth there, but, it's also pretty simplistic. When he'd be challenged by critics on that, he would oftentimes, and most of his critics, of course, most scholars back in these days were of the upper classes because they're the people that got the advantage of higher education and they could afford to make a living as a scholar. So oftentimes when he was critiqued, Marx would dismiss his critics and say, well, you're just part of the bourgeois class. That's why you think that, see? And yet if you think about it, see, there's a basic logical fallacy here, and that is if we are merely the product of our own, you might say, sociological status in life, if we're really just products of our own demographic status, then this principle, one would assume, would apply to Karl Marx as well as it would apply to anybody else. But see, he's another one of these who argues as if he's above and beyond common humanity, so he's above and beyond his social class. Because remember, he was born into a pretty well-to-do family, a bourgeois family. But see, Marx posits himself as the self-accepting fallacy, what we call in philosophy the self-accepting fallacy, and that is everybody is a product merely of their social class, except me, say, because I'm over and above all this, and I can see all this that everybody else is mired in. So, it's a common fallacy among a lot of these people that we're studying in this course. They all see themselves as above and beyond common humanity. Comments?
Questions? Anything? Yes, Bob.
Did he believe that each person should try to pull himself above the class, that all classes just shouldn't be combined?
Oh, that's a good question. See, Marx would say the deck is stacked against you. You can't rise above your station because the people above you won't let you. Again, I mean, his goal is a revolution to overturn the social and political system, and in its true essence, that's what a revolution is. It's an overturning, where the people on the bottom wind up on top, and vice versa. But I mean, how many real human beings did he actually know in life? I mean, it sounds like he's operating purely on the theoretical level and doesn't sound much like he's actually had much engagement with real human beings. But again, having said that, of course, Europe was excessively status conscious, class conscious, far more than obviously here in America. Just watch Downton Abbey, and in Downton Abbey, of course, in the 20th century, a lot of that rigid class system's breaking down, but still, it's just absurd, we often say that in American history, our critical weakness, our Achilles heel has been race, racism, all kinds of racial problems. In Europe and Britain, it's class. That's where so much of the tension and conflict has come from. So. John.
Dickens didn't start writing until 1836. So it was only, 12 years after that, the 1848 came along.
Mm-hmm.
And Dickens was describing all these things.
That's right.
That's just the way it was. That's the way Victorian England was. But she came along in 1837.
Yeah. See, and Dickens at least starts out as being sort of indicative of this Christian humanitarian ideal. Now, I understand later in life I don't know if he ever disavowed Christianity, but he starts out as basically a Christian humanitarianist. So Dickens would agree with Marx as far as a lot of the oppression and class snobbery
that bourgeois upbringing to begin with.
Yes.
And saw what was going on.
That's right. And it bothered him greatly, as it would have, I think, anyone with a, moral, social conscience. Yeah. So Karl Marx, all of history is a class struggle, see? And that's why he states in the Communist Manifesto, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. So the rich and the poor, they're constantly at each other for control of wealth and the means of production. And he would say, you can trace this all the way back again to ancient Greece and even probably before that. But in our day and time, in other words, the mid-19th century, the struggle is between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. In other words, the struggle is between the capitalist class and the working class. And so he'll constantly use those terms. And, of course, the bourgeoisie, well, those are the oppressors. And the proletariat, well, that's everything from peasant farmers to yeoman farmers to industrial workers to shop workers and so on. That's the underclass. And, of course, in his day, there wasn't very much of a middle class. Again, here in America, we always had more of a middle class than typically was the case in Europe and even in Britain. So Marx is living during a period in which the Industrial Revolution is really, really gearing up, and there is a lot of social and economic upheaval going on at this time. Modern nations like Germany and like Britain are converting from a rural agriculture-based economy to a more modern urban industry-based economy. And industrialists are trying to gobble up natural resources and convert them into factory-produced finished goods. And workers are oftentimes grossly overworked and grossly underpaid. There are no workers' rights. And many of these workers will toil in miserable and unsafe working conditions. And this is one of those issues that Charles Dickens, among others, and a lot of Christian humanitarians will write about this and the problems in their society. Now, according to Marx, see, capitalism is by nature evil. And industrial society alienates and degrades people. Because workers in a capitalistic industrial society, workers are only valued as units of production. In other words, an employee in a factory basically sells himself to his employers, and he's treated as a commodity. And he's merely a unit of production. They don't value him, as a human being. It's merely what they can get out of him. And again, there's a lot of truth in this. Now, in industrial factories, furthermore, men are serving machines rather than machines serving men. In other words, what's the more valuable commodity in a factory? Is it this man here or is it this machine? Well, it's the machine. The machine's worth far more than this human being is. And so Marx will focus in on that. And he says, in our factories, in our industries, factory workers are really just appendages of the machine. So he says, not only are workers being oppressed and exploited by the managers in the factory and the owners of the factory, the capitalists, but the workers are even oppressed by the machines themselves. And so workers feel very, very worthless, very exploited. By the way, the best satire, I think, on capitalistic exploitation and industrial society that I've ever seen is the old Charlie Chaplin classic film, Modern Times. Anybody seen Modern? It was made in the 1930s. Anybody seen it? Okay. Yeah, sometime, check it out or get it from Amazon. It's a very entertaining movie, but again, it I think, depicts the worst aspects of this very, very well. Now, it's worse than that, though, because workers don't even receive full compensation for this backbreaking labor that they're involved in on a constant basis. And see, in other words, they're putting far more in to the products that they're producing than they're getting out of it in terms of their pay. And so Marx calls this the surplus theory, the theory of surplus value. In other words, workers put all this effort and time. They produce a product that's sold at market for a certain amount, but the worker doesn't get anywhere, doesn't get anything comparable to the value of the thing that he's just produced. So what's the differential there? Where's the rest of the money going? And he'll say, well, it's going to their exploiters, the capitalists, the owners of the industries and the managers and so on. And he'll say, you know, these are people who, in the case of the capitalists, they don't break a sweat, you know, whereas the workers are working themselves to death and they're grossly underpaid. And again, they're oftentimes working in very unsafe, unsanitary conditions as well. So he says, you know, this profit that goes to the capitalists, that profit is being stolen from the workers. So that's the surplus, the theory of surplus value, that the wealth that capitalists are acquiring, that's money that should rightly be going to their workers, but is being stolen instead. So anyway, we'll come back and critique a lot of this, but just suffice it to say that despite all of his failings and despite his ulterior motives, I mean, Marx can be an astute social critic. Stephen Evans, a great Christian apologist today, writes that Marx had a deep understanding of the human need for genuine community and for fulfillment in work. He was sensitive not merely to the problem of poverty, but to the loss of human dignity which occurs when human beings are seen merely as cogs in an industrial machine. He looked for a society in which people would creatively express themselves in their work and see in their work an opportunity to help others as well as helping themselves. So Stephen Evans is saying, you know, I mean, we can't necessarily judge his motives, but again, see, there's some truth in his critique of modern society. Now, I guess we should say at this point that that's always been a great advantage by the revolutionaries in society, hardcore communists, everybody else. There's never been a society, of course, that was just and equitable and fair. And so there's always plenty of room for criticism. And a lot of these left-wing critics, again, were pretty accurate in a lot of their criticism of their society. And that would go for those that were critics of the American system as well. So there's always room for plenty of criticism. But again, the problem is, say, coming up with something that's more just and equitable and honest and humanizing, and in that sense, they fail miserably. Okay, any comments, questions before we move on? Bob?
Did he have any writings where he realized the advantage of propaganda? It seems like every place...
Well, he was a master of propaganda.
Did he have a mechanism? Well... Yeah, I don't know if he, every place it works, it seems like propaganda is an absolutely necessary cog in that wheel.
Well, again, you're living in an imperfect society, and he's really astute at pointing out the imperfections and all the exploitation in their society. So it's easy to, you know, manipulate people that way. So what's his solution? Well, basically he's saying, you know, that don't expect society to get any better through gradual change. You know, democratic socialism or utopian socialism, Christian socialism, or anything like that. Because after all, if we are products of our social class, capitalists are innately evil, and they're not going to change one bit. The only thing that's going to change things is a violent revolution, and hence, you know, his emphasis on that. Now, those that would oppose revolution, and by the way, the revolution is being waged on behalf of, quote, the people. And this is one of these Marxist code words that they've used ever since his time. In other words, real, honest people are those who are part of the underclass and are being oppressed and exploited and so on. If you're of a higher class, then you don't qualify as being the people. Okay, you're merely a counter-revolutionary and part of the bourgeois class and part of the problem. Okay, so obviously, if you have a violent revolution and overthrow the existing systems and the existing government, you're not going to be able to transform human beings overnight from being competitive, dog-eat-dog type people into being benevolent and generous and open, because they've been conditioned all their life and for generations to be hyper-competitive. And so we've got to have a transitional period here whereby the exploited class has been taught how to be benevolent and sharing. And so Marx will refer to this interim period as the dictatorship of the proletariat. And in this period, which it was very ill-defined in Marxism, because frankly, the man didn't have a clue how any of this was going to work. But the idea is, you know, you've got to have some people in your society who see things as they truly are, who can kind of manage this transitional state from capitalistic exploitation and competition to a pure communistic society in which everybody is sharing and loving one another. So who's going to affect that transition? Well, Marx says that it has to come from the radical intelligentsia. In other words, people like who? Well, no, people like himself, say. In other words, people who have this grand understanding of the problems in society and a grand vision for how society can be better in the future. And so basically, he's talking about alienated intellectuals, radical intellectuals like himself. And so here he's going to create, you know, a position for him in this whole scheme of things. Society needs him, see, because he's one of the few that understands reality for what it is. So we're going to transition from a hyper-competitive capitalism with all of its exploitation into a pure communistic system, but we've got to go through an interim period here of re-education, retraining, reprogramming people, and this is the so-called dictatorship of the proletariat. And this transitional period has to be managed by the Communist Party. And this is the People's Party. And therefore, the Communist Party can only be, I mean, it's the only legitimate political party, so it has to eliminate all opposition political parties because they're all just pawns of the bourgeoisie, the class that's been overthrown. So That's how it's going to happen. And like I said, he was very, very vague about it because, it had never been done in human history and it's been an abject failure wherever it's been tried. And, for instance, the Soviet Union had a communistic system for 70 years. And I remember reading an article in the mid-80s before the fall of communism in the Soviet Union, and a Western journalist was interviewing a top Soviet politician, and the Soviet politician admitted freely that the Soviet Union was no nearer to a pure communistic state today than it was back in 1917 when the revolution broke out. So here we are almost 70 years on in the midst of this dictatorship of the proletariat, and apparently hardly any progress is being made. And so that, of course, shouldn't have been even remotely surprising. So a new classless society eventually will emerge that operates on the basis of pure communistic principles, a society based on harmony, cooperation, a society based on the principle from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And Marx sums it up this way. He says, in a sense, the theory of communism may be summed up in a single sentence, the abolition of private property. So for Marx, that may be the single most corrupting reality in all of human history is private property. And so he's going to propose, a society that that renounces that. And you see there, let's see, I believe I mentioned there in your notes, yes, the blueprint. So we have the abolition of private property. We have a heavy and progressive graduated income tax. And why? Well, again, see, rich people, well-to-do people, we need to soak them because they've gotten wealthy and rich on the backs of the poor. So if you believe that, then it stands to reason that you ought to try to confiscate as much of the wealth of wealthy people as possible. Does that sound familiar, by the way? Seems like somebody in some political party sort of buys into that, these days.
In the preamble, those values, liberty, life, and the pursuit of happiness that we put. The original of that was the pursuit of profit.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. And Jefferson thought that terming it the pursuit of happiness was broader and more inclusive than just private property. But you're right. I mean, that was the original concept as it came from John Locke. All right, thirdly here, we have the abolition of all rights of inheritance. In other words, what right do you have to the money that your parents made? You didn't earn that. So the government needs to take that money, and they can redistribute that money, in terms of trying to equalize wealth. Confiscation of all property and wealth of counter-revolutionaries and capitalists who flee the country in the wake of the communist revolution. In other words, if anybody, bugs out, as happened in Russia right after the Bolshevik Revolution, obviously all those people's wealth was confiscated to penalize them. A centralized and state-run banking system. Interesting. State control of all media communications and transportation. Of course, we hear now that the Obama administration even wants to begin regulating the internet. And we all know that the internet is like the Wild West. I mean, there's just unspeakably horrible stuff on the internet. And then there's, great information as well. But state control and regulation of the media and communication. State ownership of all industry. A classless society. Equal liability of all to labor, more equitable distribution of the population over the country. Marx even wanted to spread the population out according to what he thought would be most advantageous. And then free state-controlled education in public schools. And So, you know, we could talk a long time about the consequences of that factor. So, in short, Marx will make the point that communists everywhere should support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order. So any place in the world where there's agitation, where there's conflict, the communists need to be involved. And it doesn't matter if the movement is even a just movement. If it's disruptive to society, the communists need to be involved. And then, you know, any other movements that are agitating for social change, they need to be involved as well. So it's basically just a total and complete rejection and critique of the existing order. It's all about radical change, transformative change. And then we're supposed to trust these people after they get in power that we'll have a better society and a better system as a result. But history has shown these people are as ruthless and brutal and cruel and exploitative as anybody in all of human history. Well, let's do a critique here, a critical assessment of Marxism. And first of all, let's look at his failings, and there are many failings. As we said, in his own dogmatic way, the man was just as simplistic as the historians whom he criticized that had come before him. History is not scientific, and history is not deterministic. In other words, there are no laws of historical progression. And as an atheist, see, and a materialist, Marx overemphasizes the materialistic aspects of human history. History is very complex. It's a very complex interplay of many, many factors and forces. It's not simple, and there's no single cause explanation, such as the class struggle, say, that can account for historical change. So in that sense, he's just wrong, and he's embarrassingly wrong. His view of history is just very, very simplistic. Now, he also portrays a defective view of human nature. See, according to Marx, humanity's basically good, but we're corrupted by wealth and privilege and status and power. In other words, we're corrupted by our social class. Again, as we said, according to him, we're just materialistic creatures. We don't have a soul. I mean, no atheist believes in the concept of soul, of course. And so, according to Marx, we're just products of our environment and our social class. In other words, we are what we do. And our work and our social class defines our character, and it defines our values. And again, this is just absurd. It's stereotypical, simplistic, and so on. Now, he also fails to understand that the interests of the underclasses and the upper classes are not necessarily antagonistic. There has been antagonism throughout history, but not necessarily. In other words, the interests of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie sometimes coincide, because when you think of it, they both have a common goal, and that is to increase their standard of living and create a better life for themselves. So in that sense, they actually can cooperate for the mutual benefit of both. So in other words, class conflict is not necessarily inevitable. Again, that's really simplistic. Furthermore, capitalism can change, and it can become more humane. And certainly that's been the case here in the United States, and to some extent it's been the case in other countries as well. And it came oftentimes as a result of unionization, and it came sometimes as a result of government reforms and restrictions and so on. But nonetheless, capitalism has reformed to a great extent. Now, despite all the terrible exploitation of the working classes back in the early stages of industrialization, capitalism eventually led to higher standards of living for most people. And so in that respect, at least, see, capitalism seems to fulfill the first priority of an economic system. It takes us back to what is the purpose of an economic system. Well, it's to produce wealth, to produce goods and services. And capitalism is quite effective. In fact, the less government regulations there are, the more effective capitalism is in terms of producing wealth. And again, see, in that sense, it meets the first qualification or the first standard of an economic system. Now, as an atheist and naturalist, Karl Marx, see, has absolutely no basis, no moral basis for critiquing anything, whether it's capitalism or industrial society or history or whatever, because in order to critique these things, you have to believe that, for instance, capitalism violates a moral law, a moral principle. But if you're an atheist, where do you get your moral principles and your moral law? It doesn't come from God. It doesn't come from the Bible. Atheists have always been moral relativists. And that's integral to atheism. So an atheist really doesn't have any standing when it comes to criticizing anything or anybody for being morally or ethically corrupt. All they can say is, I don't like what you're doing. I don't approve of what you're doing. But even at that, why don't they approve? Why don't they like what you're doing? Is it just their personal opinion? See? And so this is a fundamental problem. So what's the source of all this moral outrage that he's expressing? See, on what basis can he even condemn capitalism, for instance, as being unjust? Where does he get any concept of justice at all? And furthermore, why would somebody like Karl Marx even want to work for a better society? Atheism is an absolutely bleak and nihilistic worldview. At the very best, we're only here a few years, 70, 80, 90 years or so, and then we cease to exist. So why should I care if we have a better world? I mean, I'm going to be gone and I'll cease to exist in a few years. So again, it's a critical component, to Marx's whole critique. Now, when it comes to Marx and Christianity, again, he's very antagonistic, obviously. And early in his life, he's influenced by a couple of books that we've referred to. First of all, David Strauss's book, The Life of Jesus Christ, Critically Examined. David Strauss, as we talked about last week, was one of these early historical Jesus critics who believed that the Jesus of the Bible has little, if anything, to do with the real historical Jesus. And Marx reads this and is very much influenced by it. Another book that influences Marx is Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity. And remember, in that book, Feuerbach made the case that Christianity is merely a human invention. And furthermore, it's actually worse than just being a human invention. Christianity is worthless. It's because it focuses people's attention on heaven and on pleasing an imaginary God instead of trying to make this world a better place. So these are two works in particular that very much influence Marx. And then he also read the infamous book by Bruno Bauer, in which Bauer tried to make the case that there actually never even was a historical Jesus. You know, that's what we call the mythicist view. And Marx read that and was influenced. And so it's on that basis that Marx will make his statements that religion is merely an opiate. It's a drug. And it's an attempt to deflect people's opinion or deflect people's attention from what really matters in this life, which is this world. Okay, and as he writes, man is the supreme being for man. And in the Communist Manifesto, he'll write that the charges against communism by religious people are not even worthy of serious examination. So he's totally dismissive in that sense. And so as a militant atheist, see, he really fails to appreciate that belief in God is a basic human need. Belief in God provides a basis for morality. Belief in God provides a basis by which we can transcend our own selfish interests, because we understand that the goal in life is not ego gratification. The goal in life is to please God. And therefore, any basis for social welfare and charity and goodness comes from a fundamental belief in a good and benevolent God. So let's end on that note. I guess the final word would be the man is a brilliant fraud. He tries to pass his own opinions off as being scientific and scholarly and so on, but actually his ideas are just projections of his own biases. Most of his theories are just half-baked, unbalanced, erroneous ideas of how the world works and how history works. He certainly at times can be very keen and very insightful, but the man's very erratic. He's very dogmatic, and he's just hopelessly biased, okay? And because of his anti-God atheism. And so whether Karl Marx was kind of a well-meaning crank, or whether he was truly an evil genius, opinions kind of divided on that. But certainly the man lacks any moral basis for any of his beliefs and theories. And it seems as though he never really got beyond the anger and the reactionary bitterness of his younger years when he was denied a university teaching position. So with that, any quick comments, observations, questions?
If the mind is going to get into a battle with no strategy to manage it or exit it, gets out. And they have these ideals of getting in and doing things, but no idea of how they run it without barring some of the elite for class to come in and then manage it, or no basis of good.
He hates Western civilization, and he wants to see it destroyed. But he has not a clue what to replace it with that's going to be better and more humane and more decent and more fair. In fact, he's going to have to rely upon totalitarian government to force this dictatorship of the proletariat, you know, on the people. Bob?
Yes, I'm sorry. John?
It just struck me there's a similarity between Marx not providing well for his family and Socrates not providing well for his family. Both of them were so focused on their philosophy to the detriment of their making a good living.
Well, one's a heck of a lot more admirable than the other one. At least one is trying to improve society and our understanding of morality. And
he was trying to help society too.
To give him the benefit of the doubt, I guess you could say that he might have been honest to some extent, but that's pretty questionable in itself. The man was just very, very vindictive and mean and cruel, and so not a very admirable character. Dan, and then we'll break here.
Because of its seeming comprehensive explanatory power and sort of evangelistic potential, as backed by, of course, by military force that eventually arises in any communist country. And combined with its borrowing from the Judeo-Christian tradition, all these concepts of justice and righteousness and all this, Francis Schaeffer and many others have seen communism as a Christian heresy.
Yes.
What would you say about that?
Any higher ideals or motives that you would find in this are borrowed from the Bible and from Christian tradition. And concepts of
justice and equality and, you know, better, you know, a good society and all. Yeah. Again, atheists would have no basis for that whatsoever. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a surrogate religion, isn't it? The left, in general, is a surrogate religion. It's a, it's an atheistic, socialistic surrogate religion.
I hope they're happy now that opiates are the religion of the people.
Yeah, well, our society is being being overrun with opiates these days, isn't it? So, all right, well, if you thought this was bad, just wait till next week. It gets no better. In fact, next week, that's the crown jewel, to use a very inappropriate metaphor. It's probably the worst book in our whole list because of its insidious influences and ramifications. So we'll look at Charles Darwin and Origin of Species and the Descent of Man, and I think you'll find it extremely insightful. So.